I'd like to call the Environment Policy Oversight Committee to order for March 19th. We do have a quorum, so I'd like to first approve the minutes of March 18th, last night's meeting. Representative McNamara.
Yep, Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Representative McNamara moves the minutes for March 18th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Representative Atkins. As a bill before us today, and we'll try to move right along since I know you've got a committee to chair yourself.
And I appreciate your consideration.
And normally I'd be having a bill heard in your committee tonight. The last time we did this, we each had a bill in each other's committee. But Representative Atkins, I will move your bill, House File 1675. Be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. Representative Atkins to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you'd be so kind as to move the A1 amendment, it's an author's amendment that will put it in the shape with which I'd like to proceed. It simply deletes Subdivision 3, which proved to be a little bit controversial, and we don't want that.
Okay, we do not have a copy of the A1 amendment. Is there a copy that we could have?
Mr. Chair, it's so highly complex. All I'm doing is, we could even do it orally. It's just delete subdivision 3 on page 2.
Delete subdivision 3 on page 2. Okay. I will move the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Atkins to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm joined by Alex Wolf in case there's technical questions, but it's a very straightforward bill. Last year we passed a law that took into account some gases that are referenced as super warmers. Here we're trying to reduce emissions, trying to take care of global warming gases. Carbon dioxide tends to be the villain that everybody refers to. But the handful that are really, really bad are things like sulfur hexafluoride, nitrous trifluoride, and others, some of which are 23,000 times as powerful as carbon dioxide. And they're used occasionally with refrigerants, air conditioning systems and vehicles, that sort of thing. We moved this through last year because we figured out, on both sides of the aisle, and working with the industry folks, that there's actually some very reasonable, cost-effective, sometimes even cheaper alternatives to using these sort of super warming gases as opposed to ones that do not have those similar kinds of harmful effects. We're now at the rulemaking stage, and that was the recommended course. It is a technical area, so we're moving through and asking that the PCA take care of the rulemaking. Obviously, industry and any interested parties will have an opportunity to weigh in as they go through the rulemaking stage. And that's what the bill does, and we'd appreciate your support for it. With that, I'd stand for any questions or concerns that members may have.
Great. Thank you. I don't know if Ms. Wolf, if you'd have any words.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think Representative Atkins gave a great summary of the bill. It's a complex area, but this is a very simple bill, and we are really going to rely on the expertise of the Pollution Control Agency to provide some methods for phasing out the worst of these super warmers and doing it in a method that starts with the areas where it can be done in a cost-effective manner. And frankly, what the Climate Change Advisory Group found is that some of these substitutions actually save money, either for the business or for consumers. So we're asking PCA to focus on those areas first.
Okay. Ms. Wolf, any questions for Representative Atkins or Ms. Wolf? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins and Ms. Wolf, I've never heard the term super warmers before. I just kind of wonder, given the fact that we're in a period of global cooling here, what exactly this means. But what is the cost of this mandate to businesses? Has that been calculated?
Representative Atkins.
Representative Ruskowski, if you'd want, we can have all of the super warmer gases down in your neck of the woods and we'll just warm up your little part of the world, I suppose. But what the study recognized is that it may actually cost them less. Most of the industry folks that have contacted me, including an old high school classmate of mine that went on to work for Visteon, which is Ford Motor Company's air conditioning unit, said that once they started looking into this, they realized they could actually do it possibly more cheaply using the new alternatives rather than some of these gases that contribute to global warming. So when you talk about it being a cost, a mandate to business, it might actually net a savings to some of them.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Atkins, I mean, the businesses couldn't figure, if this is going to be something, a decision on their end that they couldn't figure out on themselves, that we need government to come in and tell them that it's going to be cheaper for them, something doesn't quite match what common sense would tell you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, that's a great question. The fact is there's just something that don't know about it. We are, and as much as it might be in their own best interest because they find out it's less expensive, it is one of those areas that, you know, you've done it this way for years and years, and I shouldn't oversell it. There's some where it may not be cheaper, but it might be a very reasonably priced alternative. And we want to make sure that they've had an opportunity to be heard. Everybody gets a chance through the rulemaking process to weigh in on what would be reasonable, what would not be reasonable, and then let the experts actually adopt some rules that make some sense.
And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. In your bill, you specifically list four gases, and then you add any other gases the agency deems to have that potential. Are there more gases? What does that any other gas part mean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, another excellent question. We actually found one since last year. Nitrous trichloride is 17,000 times as powerful as carbon dioxide with respect to global warming. And rather than legislatively prescribe, you know, gas by gas by gas, we thought it might make better sense just to let the experts work at it and work with the industry folks to try to find those reasonably priced alternatives.
Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Ms. Wolf, do you have some information? We just have something here from the Air Conditioning and Heating Refrigerant Institute, and I'm wondering, they ask about a certain gas here, but is that not applied to this bill?
Ms.
Wolf.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I briefly saw that letter before the committee hearing. I think it just came in, you know, not too long before we all started here. It does refer to refrigerants, which are included under the definition in last year's bill. It appears to come from a trade association for folks in the refrigerant business. It seems, however, to misconstrue this bill as one that will result in a series of bans of products, and that's certainly not the intention of the bill. It's intended to phase out and substitute where cost-effective substitutes are available. There may be small, you know, there may be instances in which a product ban might be appropriate, but that's certainly not the focus of the bill.
Yes. President McNamara.
If I can ask, Mr. Chair, where is the bill going from here?
We are sending it to the Committee on State and Local Government.
And if I can ask the author, Representative Atkins, will the bill go before Representative Wagenius' committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I don't believe that Representative Wagenius has asked for it yet, but we're going wherever anybody wants it.
I do not believe there's a fiscal impact. Okay. No fiscal note to it. Okay. And Representative Gardner.
Thank you. This question is maybe for Ms. Walsh, who's probably memorized the MCAG report. Does this check off anything from the MCAG recommendations, and was there any estimate on how many tons of CO2 equivalent we're knocking off here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, this is a recommendation of the Climate Change Advisory Group, and it results in, I think, 500,000 tons of CO2 equivalent being reduced over the next, let me just pull out my chart here. 500,000 tons by 2025. The amount of impact is great for the cost of these efforts. Because of the powerful effect of these gases, modest efforts result in a greater impact. You can imagine if something is 17,000 times more powerful than CO2, that you can have a bigger bang, so to speak, with a smaller effort than we can get with addressing CO2. So It's not an enormous effect, but we felt, especially with the cost savings, it is one of the few MTAG recommendations that actually reflects a negative cost, in other words, a cost savings. There are a few recommendations that appear with a negative dollar figure, and this is one of those.
Okay. And as far as the percentage that these super warmers comprise of the global warming gases that are emitted by people, do you have any figures on that? I'm just curious about the total impact that it currently has, and whether this is an area of growing concern. Are the super warmers becoming more of a factor in the global warming gases?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question. One of the reasons that the MTAG folks suggested addressing this is that despite it being only about 2% of the global emissions problem, in Minnesota it's a little bit higher than 2%, and the rate of increase is fairly steep. So it's an area where the idea is to at least level that off and start to reduce, because of various consumer products and other things, it's been reduced. It's been increasing at a fairly steep rate.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. I see none. So I will renew the motion that House File 1675, as amended, be recommended to pass to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Next we have Representative Horstman. Okay, Representative Horstman. And I will move House File 877 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. And I understand, Representative Hortman, you do have an author's amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. You want me to explain it?
I will move the amendment quickly first. I will move House File or the amendment 80877A1. So, Representative Hortman to the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 877, as it was originally drafted, would have asked for $1 million in general fund money to help trucking companies purchase diesel idling reduction technology. But we all know what's going on with our general fund, and we're a little short there. And so that's why this bill sort of sat on the back burner. And I wasn't really going to push it this year. But then the federal stimulus money came through, and there is a program in the federal economic stimulus for clean diesel and reducing diesel idling. And so there's some money that we can competitively apply for. Right now, Mr. Chair and members, the PTA is not planning to apply for the competitive grants that are available under the federal economic stimulus plan. They're going to let other folks in Minnesota who might be interested in working on this area apply for these grants. And my perspective as a state legislator is I want to get as much of that federal economic stimulus money here in Minnesota as we can. So what the A1 amendment does is it says we'll ditch the general fund request and instead request that the PCA apply for $1 million from the federal government in that competitive grant process. And if they are awarded that $1 million in the competitive grant process, that they will spend it as described in House File 877, helping the trucking industry to become cleaner and greener and cheaper.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Representative Hortman. I will renew the motion that that the A1 amendment be passed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted, and Representative Hortman to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amber Vachis is here from the Minnesota Trucking Association, or representing the Minnesota Trucking Association, and I'll let her go ahead.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Vachis. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Vachis, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association. The Minnesota Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing 700 member companies of all shapes and sizes within the trucking industry. And we appreciate Representative Hortman's desire to renew our push for a state grant program so that truckers can help the environment. With the large budget deficit the state is facing, this is an initiative we have given up on, but we are grateful that Representative Hortman would like to pursue federal dollars available through the stimulus package to make this program viable in Minnesota. Today, trucks in Minnesota consume over 70 million gallons while idling, which annually contributes to production of 9.5 million tons of CO2 nationally. These auxiliary power units, which can help heat, cool, and run appliances within the truck, so you won't have to run it, engine, can lower CO2 emissions by as much as 80%. During the past decade, the trucking industry has made tremendous strides in reducing emissions. The days of black smoke coming out of diesel exhaust stacks are fast disappearing. Since 1994, the industry has reduced particulate matter emissions by an astounding 90%, while reducing nitrous oxide emissions by an equally impressive 50%. This has been accomplished by the introduction of a series of new engines. Each new engine, while cleaner for the environment, is more costly, and the models that have been available through 2007, less fuel efficient. Fortunately, the 2010 engines are expected to reduce emissions further and make gains in fuel economy. However, they are expected to cost $20,000 more than engines at the start of this decade. Fuel costs have also increased, and while we're finally getting some relief as an industry from the $5 per gallon for diesel, fuel is still higher than it is for gas. The cost of diesel is still higher than gasoline. And in this world economy, all these things add up for the trucking industry. While the industry is looking at doing everything they can to run cleaner and greener, as Representative Hortman said, the cost of this technology isn't cheap. The average auxiliary power unit costs anywhere from $1,500 to $10,000, and in a slow economy where credit is tight, that's tough for a trucker to swallow and to pay for these sort of elective technologies right now. So this grant program would help the industry immensely, and we're very glad that this could leverage dollars. The association is getting a lot of calls from members who have heard TV chatters out there talking about federal money that's available, so they would like the opportunity to try to make this work in the state. So we thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Backus. Any questions for Representative Hortman or Ms. Backus?
Commissioner Chair, I would like to add before questions, just a comment about the handouts. There's one about diesel exhaust emission in Minnesota and the issues, health and otherwise related with that. But also there's a summary of what an auxiliary power unit is. And before the Trucking Association approached me to carry legislation in the last biennium, I didn't know that in order to keep their truck warm to sleep at night or cool in the summer, they have to run the engine the whole time unless they have the ability to plug into something or an auxiliary power unit. And the auxiliary power unit is a way to create power for the heat and air conditioning without running the engine. So it saves them a lot on fuel. It's much more efficient for those purposes of the truck.
And Representative Loon, do you have a question?
Thank you, Representative Portman. And either for, well, I guess this would be to you, the handout that you also gave us from the EPA regarding these grants, it looks like the turnaround time for those are pretty quick. Is that kind of figuring into the strategy here for moving this? My guess is this would have to be approved and on its way to have us participate in this program.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I am hoping to get this bill to the General Register and off to the Senate or off to the Governor's desk as fast as possible. I think there's also... this also sends a signal to the PCA that we would like them to get as much federal money as they can, not just in this program, but in other programs we might find out about.
Representative Loon.
Well, just to follow up, is it fair to say that they're supportive of this and ready to go?
Representative
Hartman. Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I just found out about this program on Sunday and got the amendment drafted and got ready to be here in committee today. So I haven't had an opportunity to speak with them, but the short conversation I've had that didn't go all the way up the chain of command is that they're supportive of this effort.
Okay. Nine more. Anyone from the agency would want to testify? Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Would trucks be required to have these warming units on them, Representative Hartman?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no. This would be a program to help them purchase them. And it's modeled after a Wisconsin program that really targets the smaller trucker, so maybe the guy that owns his own truck or the smaller company that the long-term fuel savings don't make it so they can just go out and buy one of these off the shelf. They just don't have that kind of capital.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
And one more question. Would you agree or say that any truck that runs in the northern areas such as this would need that more extensive unit that would provide heat to the fuel and engine?
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, perhaps Amber can answer that question. I don't. I didn't know that there's different kinds of APUs. I only know that there's such a thing as an APU, and that it takes less diesel than the engine.
Well, and it's a good question because there was quite a price range there between $1,500 and $10,000. Ms. Backus, I don't know if you have any information on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will have to follow up with you because I do have some basic information about the different types, and it depends on the fuel source, the battery-powered versus those using the diesel, but I'd have to follow up and see if the more expensive one is necessary in this environment. We expect, I think, that the average cost would be around $5,000 for these, which is what we've seen in Wisconsin, so that would probably be what it would be here in Minnesota as well. I can follow up with you.
So, in Alaska, maybe it's $10,000. any other questions? Representative Loon.
Sorry, and I should have asked you this before. You mentioned really that this would be, as I see it, something to really help small businesses. Is there a requirement within the programs and structures that MPCA or the administrator of the grantor at the state level be targeting those funds for small business owners, or is that something you'd be amenable to, Representative Portman?
Ms. Backus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, actually, if you look at lines 2.11 through 2.14, that gets to making sure that one company can't use more than 20% of the funds and that 25% of the money goes to companies with fewer than 20 trucks. So hopefully that will distribute it and evenly across the industry and focus more on that lower end. And if you're not comfortable with those amounts, we're open to changing it.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 877 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it go to Environment Finance. And Representative Hortman, if you have any final words before.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I figured it should probably go through Environment Finance, even though it's like maybe we get the money, maybe we don't.
Okay. Right. All those in favor? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
The
bill is passed. Okay, let's see. Then next we have Representative Olin. House File 353. I will move that House File 353 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And welcome, Representative Olin, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And by way of information, some of you have seen this bill last year because it did get to the General Register last year without a whole lot of dissent, but for some reason never got acted on after it got there for lack of time, I think it's called, but whatever, it stayed there. So I'm back again. Basically what this bill is a request on behalf of the cities and the counties along Lake of the Woods, which are semi and mostly in my district, although not all in my district, but parts would also be in Representative Anzell's district, that the control of the water quality, or the people that do the examination and reports on the water quality, should be the International Joint Commission rather than the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, which last year declared this area, the Lake of the Woods, an impaired waters, even though the state of Minnesota only has 31% of the entire waters of the Lake of the Woods. 69% are all actually Canadian. So this is basically a resolution requesting that the issue of water quality examination and reports be turned over to the International Joint Commission, which incidentally was formed in the year by a boundary treaty back in 1909, so the commissions existed 100 years between Canada and the United States, and that's the reason the people in my district and Ontario has also sent me a letter. I believe you got information from all the Minnesota sources that I had it from, but that's what it does. It requested it be a resolution sent off indicating that this belongs in the International Joint Commission.
Yes. Any questions at all, Representative Olin?
Beautiful.
Okay. Seeing none, I will, I'm sorry, Representative Diskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olin, what are the impairment what are the impairment elements in Lake of the Woods?
I'm not sure exactly. Excuse me. Thanks, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Drazkowski. I'm not exactly sure what they called impaired. I don't think there's any question that Lake of the Woods may have some problems in certain areas, but I think the International Joint Commission is the place that should figure it out because it overlaps into Canadian waters or U.S. waters, so the state of Minnesota couldn't totally control one way or the other if it did do anything.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 353 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Bill is adopted. The bill is passed. We will move on next to Representative Detmer, House File 671. And I will move House File 671 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. Welcome, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. House File 671 is supported by the DNR, and the current law provides the state park fee entrance is waived for a totally 100% disabled veteran. And this came to my attention when a constituent of mine was at a park with one of his friends who's also a totally disabled veteran from Wisconsin. And my friend got into the park free, and the Wisconsin person had to pay. He was very embarrassed. So I put this bill together that would eliminate the location where you're living to get into the park, our state park system. And just a note to that our comparison, that most national parks have waived the charge for fees and access to their parks to the U.S. park system and access free of charge to all disabled veterans, regardless where they live. And we're just asking that we allow disabled veterans to enter our state parks who are totally disabled veterans. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Detmer. Representative Junkie.
Representative Detmer, this would have been a lot easier to pass if you'd have said the DNR didn't support it. Then we had our
yeah.
But we're thinking through it right now. We're not exactly sure what to do over here.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 671 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance, again with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Thank you.
Bill, thank you. Yep. Next, Representative Taylor. Okay, and welcome, Representative Taylor. If you want to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1648 to be recommended to pass and to move on to the Commerce Committee.
Okay, Representative Taylor moves House File 1648 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Taylor to the bill.
Okay. Yeah, this is, again, for the a little fix that needs to be made to the e-waste bill. The e-waste bill, of course, was passed and became effective July of 2007, and the program was very, very effective. We were, to some extent, a victim of our own success. But at any rate, the program was put in place with really a very broad coalition, and the situation that's happening now is we collected more electronics than were anticipated. So at any rate, we end up with a situation with the manufacturers having reached their goals, often maybe 2-3 years out ahead of time. So what we need to do is, this bill originally was planned to have a review after 2 years. And due to the fact that we were very successful and collected a lot of electronics already, and due to some of the economic changes that have occurred well beyond our control nationally, we need to just do a little quick fix to change a few things with this bill. And that, and rather, that's what this bill is about, until we can get to the point where we've got the regular reporting and reassessment of the program. So what this bill will do is it there will be three changes. It adopts the national sales data rather than having the local retailers report it. It removes a 3-year limit on how long the credits could be held over, and it puts a cap on the percentage of credits of the manufacturer's obligation that can be used in any year. We just tried to, you know, just have a few testifiers, but we have a number of people here to answer questions if any others come up. But I think I'll just have Mr. John Steiner from Polk County and from the Solid Waste Administrators. We'll be talking about the county's situation with this.
Okay, thank you. And I understand that you also have amendments that you would like to offer. I don't know if you'd want to do that at this time, or a couple of oral amendments.
Mr. Chair, I could. I just have a couple of oral amendments. We actually did meet, you know, the manufacturers, the recyclers, the counties, everyone got together. We've been working on this. No one is totally happy with it, and no one is totally, you know, against it. And I guess it's, that seems to be where you go in an agreement like this. So at any rate, what the intent is to, again, to just kind of get us through until we can do the complete reassessment. But I can give you those oral amendments now. On page 2.15, actually that one is, I don't have to change that one, I'm sorry, it's 2.16. Which is provided no more than 15% of a manufacturer's obligation. I would change that to 25, so substitute 25 for 15.
Okay, Representative Taylor moves that on page 2, line 2.16, strike 15 and insert 25.
And I have one other.
Sure, we'll do that amendment first then, and then we'll move on to the second. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Taylor to the next amendment.
And the second amendment, just as with regard to the effective date, where we would just scratch out effective the day following final enactment, scratch that, and instead put effective July 1st, 2009.
Okay. So again, that would be on line 4.1.
4.2.
Okay. So strike the day following final enactment and insert July 1st, 2009.
That's correct.
Again, on line 4.2. We want to understand the amendment. All those, and I will move, or Representative Taylor renews the motion to pass the amendment, the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. So thank you, Representative Taylor, and Mr. Stein, if you want to speak to the bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, Mr. Chairman, committee members, to talk to you about this bill and this program. My name is John Steiner. I'm the Solid Waste Administrator for Polk County, Minnesota. I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Solid Waste Administrators Association. I suppose I should probably start off by saying that this program, this electronic waste program that was passed in 2007, has been an excellent program. It's been very successful in capturing electronic waste and getting that out of the waste stream. It's actually been, unfortunately, too successful. It's resulted in collecting much more waste than anticipated. And the way the law is structured, it allows that extra weight to be carried over to future years as credit.
for the manufacturers. And that kind of brings us to the crossroads we're at with the program right now. What we're finding is the manufacturers have so many credits built up that there's no demand in the market anymore. So for the recyclers and collectors of electronic waste, we're left without any demand for that product. In essence, the manufacturers, because they have 3 years in which to use those credits, are planning to, I believe, spend all those credits down and not participate in the market until they've gone through most or all those credits. What that will end up meaning to counties, which Nancy I'm here representing, is that we're going to end up having to pay to get rid of these electronics, to get those recycled. And the fees for that are basically the same as the fees were before we had the electronic waste law to recycle. Put those in dollars for you. Most of the counties had some sort of arrangement with the recycler, which was piggybacked off an arrangement between a recycler and a manufacturer, where the collectors were getting about 2 cents a pound, so about $40 a ton revenue to come in and help offset some of their program costs, the advertising, the consolidation, organizing the materials and getting them ready for shipment. What we're being told, and I'm a county that's had our agreement terminated, is that we're again end up paying between $300 and $600 a ton to get rid of them. And of course, if we're not getting money coming in, then someone has to pay the bill, and they'll end up being the end users of the program again. And from the counties we've talked to, charges will range somewhere between $10 and up to $70 for those very large TVs to get rid of. And again, the reason for having the program was to make sure those things weren't being illegally disposed of. Where they dumped a roadside ditch, thrown in a back alley somewhere. What we see in a lot of cities is, residents go in and throw them in some business's dumpster after hours. So it's a business's problem to deal with it. And we're trying to avoid that at all costs. But unfortunately, just because the market doesn't dictate that there's demand for that product anymore, we still have the ban at the landfills and the incinerators not to dispose of that. So our hands are tied. We do have to provide that service in some manner. Without some sort of action, we feel this program's in serious jeopardy. We can't collect at the rate we were collecting and then simply shut it off for a year or two. What's going to happen is those businesses that got into electronic waste collection are probably going to stay out of it. The volatility will drive them out. Counties, cities that got involved with it are going to be reluctant to get back into it again 2 years, 3 years later when the manufacturers need tonnage again to meet their obligation. Just for simple fact, no one wants to be left holding a truckload of electronics they're going to have to pay for down the road. For county I represent, that bill is probably going to come to somewhere between $25,000 and $35,000 annually if we were to continue collecting at the rate we are. The first program year, we were very successful in collecting electronics. We collected well over what we thought we could. And the second program year numbers track that there's going to be a giant increase in the volume of waste coming in from the first program year. For Polk County, we're looking at almost being double what we did in first program year. The PCA did just a real quick sample of what we have here, 9 counties, and the average increase was about 40-45% over the first program year. So the numbers are going in 2 different directions. We have a high stockpile of these credits from the first program year. The recycling numbers, the materials coming in the door, are increasing at a very high rate. The manufacturer's obligation actually is going down because their obligation is derived off their sales. And in this economic climate, their sales figures aren't the best, is what we're hearing. So, we're at a crossroads. We're very afraid that if we don't do something, that we are looking at having this program basically be irrelevant. We're going to go back to the same sort of situation we were before the law. Going through Representative Saylor's bill, it had
three basic parts to it. One was using the sales data, national sales data, that would relieve the retailers of the burden of trying to come up with those reports for the manufacturers each year. As we understand it, that's a plus to the retailers, alleviates the burden for them. Going to requiring the manufacturers to participate to a certain level, in this case with the author's amendment, 75% of their annual obligation will have to be actually recycled in that year. They'll only be able to use 25% of their obligation from credits from previous years. So we won't have them, you know, for 1 year, 2 years, just simply bleeding down those that stockpile of credits and not participating in the market. But realizing that brings you to the third part of that, which is right now in law, those credits have to be used within 3 years as they expire. If we're going to cap the manufacturer's ability to use their credits in any given year, this bill proposes to get rid of that 3-year expiration date on the credit. And we felt that was fair in that they don't lose their investment from their first program year. It's going to take them a few extra years to use those credits, but they're not out any dollars for that first program year. Because we do recognize that they did a wonderful job in collecting electronics. We certainly don't want to punish them for doing that. But unless there's some fix, and we feel this bill is that fix, a short-term fix, but a fix nonetheless, we can continue that program on in some fashion. It's going to be a little pain for, I think, every stakeholder to comply with this. But we do realize it's a short-term fix. It just ensures that for the next couple of years that there is participation in the market, and we'll wait till the PCA has their recommendation that's required by law to come in, and we'll look at the long-term fix. So again, on behalf of AMC and Solid Waste Ministry Association, we do support this bill, and we urge your support as well. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner, and Representative Junkie.
Mr. Steiner, are we at a point now where every resident in the state has easy access to a free location to dispose of their electronic monitors and e-waste?
Mr. Steiner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, I don't believe that's the case. There are some counties that do not have a program set up. We knew that going in. There were many counties that did not have programs set up. It's the first part of the, you know, when the program started, that number has dwindled to a handful of counties that don't have a program established. In terms of what's convenient, that's been an issue that's been debated between counties and the PCA for a while now. How far does a market have to be from a resident, you know, to get there? Is it 10 miles or 20 miles? The opportunity is much greater for them to get rid of that waste. But many counties still had a small fee on their electronics. In talking to several of them, they were just holding that out to see how the program worked. You know, a situation like this is obviously confirming their worst fears that potentially there isn't a market and then they have to charge for it. So I know, speaking from my county, we did drop our fees. In the meeting we had earlier, that was discussed as whether the program should be free or not. And as I stated at that point, you know, I was questioned at great extent about whether all the programs would be free or not, but the bill did allow for counties to charge something for their end of it.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, okay, the program is not successful until it has no fees and it's available reasonably to every resident in the state. So, again, to the counties, I suggest you continue to work with folks to get that done before we do it to you, because, again, as you stated, there's a fee, or if there's nowhere to dispose, I know exactly where they go in rural Minnesota. Either into the ditch, because I see them all the time, or right into my garbage can, and into the truck and into the landfill, which is what you were trying to avoid anyway. And so we've had that problem, members, since this program's inception. I'm happy to vote for the fix now, but this program is not 100% working in this state yet. And we knew that going in. I suspect that it's, and it's not there yet.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Steiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I agree, but it does take time to get that on board. But the market never did equalize to the point where, you know, a county was even assured that they would get service. And in fact, I know a couple counties that that subsidize the entire amount, even in the good program years. So I do agree that there are still issues, and the program does have room to grow.
Okay. Any other questions? I see none. Thank you, Mr. Steiner. I hope you have a safe trip back. I don't know if you had troubles coming down from Crookston. I heard that Highway 9 was underwater.
Mr. Chairman, when I went through, it was just about to go under. It wasn't. I've been since updated that it has, so perhaps I'll be looking for an alternative road.
Yeah. Take Highway 32, maybe. So, thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
And we have next Ms. Laura Bishop.
Hello, Mr. Chair. I'm Laura Bishop from Best Buy. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thank you, Representative Saylor, for your role, and thank you for the opportunity to address some of the minor issues with the bill. This has been a very successful program, and to Representative Junkie's point, Minnesota is one of the most successful programs in collections per capita in the whole United States for electronics recycling program. So I applaud Representative Saylor for all of her effort that she's put into this program over the years. This has been a very extensive effort on all of the working group's part and Representative Saylor's part for putting a lot of effort into this. And the 6.3 pounds per capita that has been collected over the past year and the program year is really something I think that everybody can be proud of, and I think it's a real accomplishment that we have exceeded the goals in this program. So I think it's something to be very proud of. Even if there were some fees in this, I think Minnesotans came out in droves, and the manufacturers that participated, the counties that participated, really did their job here. And I think we've done above and beyond what anyone expected. So I am very proud of that, and I think you should be proud of that as well. Best Buy looks at this law and participates in this law from a lot of different perspectives. We're a retailer, and I know that that's how we're seen, but we're also a manufacturer of our private label brands. We've manufactured televisions, computers in the past, so we are responsible for those brands under this law. We are also a collector in our haul-away programs, and in July we did a pilot program where we started collecting in all of our Minnesota stores, and in February we rolled out nationally a take-back program in all 1,000 stores nationwide where we're collecting e-waste in all of our stores. This is something that our 30 stores in Minnesota were operating our electronic take-back program. It's basically everything, any electronics. Most of the kind of goal is anything you can buy at Best Buy, you can recycle at Best Buy, except that we don't take back any refrigeration products. There is a $10 fee that Best Buy does charge for products to recycle on screen devices. However, you do get a Best Buy gift card of $10 in return for that. We do not charge for our private label products, of Insignia products, those that we manufacture. And that's part of that commitment of the things that we make ourselves, manufacture products, we do not charge a fee on. And often that's consistent with a lot of manufacturer programs that you see with an LG program or a Sony program. They do not charge fees on their own products. They might charge a fee on other products that they take in. If Sony takes in a Toshiba product, they may charge a fee on it, but they won't charge a fee on their own product. We are very supportive of the provision here that eliminates the retail reporting provision. By going to national sales data instead of having the retailers report their sales data back to the manufacturer, it really puts it on a more consistent data source and lets the PCA rely on a more consistent data source than collecting sales data from hundreds of retailers in the state and relying on different time limits. We did find that it was more difficult than we had anticipated to collect the data from
a Best Buy, a BestBuy.com, and the different data sources than we had anticipated. We did get it in a timely manner, but we do know that there were some challenges with other retailers, and we expect that a more consistent data source based on national sales data is going to result in a better program data base, and in turn, TCA estimates that they're going to get a larger poundage program allotment and data source in the end as well, where manufacturers will be responsible for anywhere from 4 to 6 million more pounds of e-waste that they're responsible for collecting. We think this is going to be ultimately a good thing for the program and help to sort out some of this gap that we know that the program's been missing. As far as the cap that they're looking at imposing in this bill, this is something that with the credits, manufacturers have really looked at this in good faith and gone into this program and worked very hard on this program, and we have as well. We have carried over some credits, and others have carried over some credits, and I do think that when you change a program midstream like this and midterm like this, that it presents some challenges, especially in an economic time like this when manufacturers are going through a difficult time, our suppliers are going through a difficult time. It prevents some challenges to change the terms on them as they've been participating in this program. I think by changing the effective date to July 1st so that it doesn't affect this program year will be helpful in that regard, but it is somewhat problematic. The county's participation in this, I think, is very good, and we do need the county collection points. I do want to also say that there are 149 private collection points registered in the state of Minnesota beyond the counties, and they are in numerous counties in the state. There are many of them that are contained in the metro area, but there are many of them that are outstate as well. So we do have a lot of participants in this program that are not the counties as well. Whether they're charging fees or not charging fees, I don't have that data. PCA would have that data. But there are a lot of options for consumers that are there. And I think with that, the program has been very successful, and we should continue to evaluate this program. And Best Buy looks forward to spending time this summer, me spending time this summer with Representative Saylor, with the PCA and others, to work hard to evaluate some of the things that might be in the program to make it more effective for consumers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bishop. Any questions for Ms. Bishop or Representative Saylor? Okay, seeing none, and don't believe there are any others that I want to testify. Oh. Do you have one other person? Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
Thanks. My name is Trisha Conroy, and I am here today representing the Electronic Manufacturers Recycling Management Company, and that big mouthful is MRM to everyone else. And I want to be very brief in my remarks. I want to thank the chair and the members of the committee for allowing me to step forward, and thank Representative Saylor both for all her work on this issue for years and for her willingness to work collaboratively and cooperatively to get the best electronics recycling program that we can. I appreciate it, and I want to be very brief. I just wanted to briefly, MRM is a joint enterprise started by Panasonic of North America, Toshiba Consumer Products Company, and Sharp Electronics. We now have 21 manufacturers participating in MRM, and we have recycled. Last year, in the first year of the Minnesota program, MRM was responsible for about 33% of the total pounds recycled in Minnesota. So we feel proud that we've been part of this successful effort. The one point that I just want to come up and clarify, we now have 21 manufacturers. I think that's creeping on almost half of all the registered manufacturers. And we recently had to cut off collections for most of our collectors in the state, and we tried very hard to avoid that. We were very disappointed to do it. We've recycled over 18 million pounds since the program started, and we look forward to continuing to recycle in Minnesota to meet our obligations. I just want to clarify, we are appreciative of Representative Saylor's willingness to
consider different options. We are hoping that a cap will not be necessary to bring stability to the system. We, too, want to find ways to stabilize and not have this ebb and flow and on again, off again for the county and private collectors. And we look forward to working on that in the future. I just want to state that by no means does MRM intend to purchase in 1 year, whether by intention or just the way the economy's gone this year, and have a large excess and then not purchase in the future. We've been talking to our current collectors and our relationships, and we hope to find ways to structure our contracts to continue to find a way to have a more consistent, stable purchasing each year so that we're not in a position that we're in this year. This year we found that we've had members go bankrupt, we've had members' sales fall off, and as all new programs, we had some members miscalculate their targets and then revise them downward. So we find ourselves over target. We had to cut collections off. We do not intend to just go away and use credits for the next few years. We will always be purchasing at a stable level because that's good business for us, and we understand the hardships for collectors of the on-again, off-again. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Conroy. Are there any questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Saylor, for bringing this forward. I just want to understand, did we misjudge how many computers were going to be bought and how much they weighed, and then did we misjudge the weight of and the number that were going to be recycled? How did we get in the spot where we are that we're so far off?
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, well, as we said, we were highly successful. There was a higher success rate than we anticipated. You know, whether it's a misjudge or, you know, not, we didn't know. We went into this, you know, at the beginning, and we hadn't had a pilot project, so we just went right into it. But we needed, you know, we weren't sure. You know, nobody was sure. We did the very best that we could. Everybody that was part of this initiative that worked on it for over 6 years was really trying to come up with a good number, you know, so that we could start out with that. And, you know, originally, you probably recall that we did start with a 1-to-1 ratio, and then that was backed down because a number of people really wanted it much less than that. So we sort of came together in the middle on that. But I do think that numbers were simply higher than we really expected. We did recognize the fact that new devices that are manufactured pretty much weigh less than the old stereos. We were all thinking about those big old consoles and know perfectly well, you know, you've got a lot more new laptops and smaller TVs being manufactured now. But I think a great deal of it was, you know, very likely just a miscalculation of, you know, we suspected that some suspected there would be more, some thought that there would be less. We had to go with a number and move the legislation forward, and we did. And that's why we required at the end of the second program year, reports, assessment, evaluation, and we're all looking forward to doing that evaluation and, you know, making changes that are necessary, which there will be.
Any other questions? Representative Junkie.
Well, just to that point, I suspect you asked a good question. I suspect that we miscalculated how many people. I think there's an education piece that's missing too, quite frankly. And I want more recycling. I want it to, you know, I want people to recycle. And I think there's an education piece. Personally, I had 3 TVs sitting in my garage until my county went free a year ago, finally. And then I hauled them all up to the dump where the site was and got rid of them for free. And I suspect that's what went on with a lot of people who actually had a conscience and didn't throw them into their garbage. They sat and waited, because I'll be darned if we're going to pay 10 or 20 or 25 bucks a piece to get rid of them. So they sat in my garage until then. Case in point, too, down here, there was an event at the Mall of America a year and a half ago. They had to shut it down because people had so much stuff. And they were lined up in Minneapolis, and they said they had free forever. But apparently people don't understand that. And they thought that was their only chance to get rid of this stuff. So I think it's a real big education piece. I would suggest there's still people, even in counties where it's free of charge, that have no idea where that site would be, that it's illegal to even put them in the garbage, and how they get them there. So I think part of it is a big education piece that's missing. But I do suspect, to begin with, if there was a big backlog sitting in basements and garages, that no one realized. And as soon as they said, oh, you can get rid of them for free now, I'll pay $20 at the landfill, all right. In they all went before the program shut down or something.
Well, I think that's a good point. And if I don't know about the education piece, there's maybe still a fairly sizable backlog out there that hasn't been tapped yet, but could be coming if people were adequately educated. Representative Turner.
Yeah, I just was going to make a point that Representative Taylor made as well, but I think the weight was a big thing. It was supposed to be a one unit to one unit, and that got taken away, and I think that was a real big issue because the weight issue overwhelmed it, and we went from weight rather than unit. So her predecessor, that was a big issue that I think he thought as well. So.
And Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to kind of follow up on what Representative Junkie was talking about, if I could ask Ms. Bishop a question. Did I understand it right that you said even under the current situation that we're in today, Best Buy is basically taking this stuff back for free if I assume that the $10 fee I pay and I get a $10 gift card, I'm going to use the gift card. And then you're doing that, are you collecting credits that may be of value in the future with this bill not being passed yet? I'm just curious to understand your motivation for doing that. And did I understand that you'll take back any TV, any computer, no matter where it was from, but you don't charge this? If I bring back an Insignia one, do I get a $10 gift card even if I don't get charged it?
Ms. Bishop.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mackman. So our Insignia products, our Insignia televisions, we started making those in 2003. So I don't know if you're going to be recycling your Insignia TV yet, but if you bring it back, you do not get a $10 gift card unless you want to be charged the fee, I guess. we will take back any screen device. The one limitation that I didn't talk about, there's two limitations on our program that I failed to mention. You can only bring two items per day, per customer per day, and we did, when we rolled out our first insert where we really advertised this, we forgot to put the two items per day, and people did drive up in truckloads of stuff, you know, nationwide. So that is an important thing to say. And the other piece is that it's anything under 37 inches. We do have any screens under 37 inches. We do have events in the state that can handle TVs over that, and then we have a TV haul away program. So if you do buy a 50-inch screen TV, we'll haul away a TV for free as well. As far as your question about credits and if we're getting credits for our program, we do have a requirement since we sell Insignia as a manufacturer. We also sell Dynex as another private label. We do have an obligation that we need to fulfill. And right now in this program year, it's been moved up to 80% of the amount that we sell. So we do have to fulfill that percent first. We did carry over some credits from last year, but it wasn't a whole lot. It doesn't meet this 25%. But we do have an amount that we have to fulfill first, and then if we have credits, we could carry those forward.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, if I remember right, and maybe this is a question for Representative Saylor, but if your program is so successful, can't you sell those credits to a competitor manufacturer? Isn't that allowed under the old bill?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bishop.
Yes.
Yes. Representative
Taylor. Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara. Yes, they could.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Bishop. And Representative Taylor, any final words?
Well, just that, Mr. Chair, members, this is a program that was worked on very, very hard for a number of years, and we just, as I say, needed to do this fix to get us through to the final two-year period where we'll really be reassessing the program. We want to keep our infrastructure in place so that we don't have to go back and reinvent everything in the meantime. So with that, I would just renew my motion.
Okay. Okay. Representative Taylor renews the motion that House File 1648, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Okay, Representative Hackforth. Hey, Mr. Hackforth, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move House File 47.
Okay, Representative...
one more on House File 47.
Okay. Representative Hackforth moves House File 487 to be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Members, this bill was an idea that I had talking to some ATV folks, and right now, if you have to go to some of the other states, you have to get a non-resident trail pass, like Wisconsin, for example. And we thought that in Minnesota we should have something like that. Right now in Minnesota, what's required, if you come from another state, your machine has to be registered in that state, and it's kind of a reciprocity agreement there, but not with Wisconsin. I mean, Wisconsin can come here and ride just because they have their machines registered in Wisconsin, but if we go to Wisconsin, just because our machines are registered in Minnesota, we still have to buy a separate trail pass in Wisconsin. So that's one example of why this is here. Another thing that's happening is it's probably not really fair for somebody from like Illinois that comes here, for example. They have to come here, and their machine, they don't register machines in Illinois. They don't register machines at all in Illinois. So if they come here, what they have to do is they have to register the machine in Minnesota in order to ride on any of the state trails or any of the Grant and Aid trails in the state of Minnesota. So they have to register as a Minnesota machine, even though they're from Illinois, and I don't think that's quite fair to them either. So I thought we would put together an annual ATV non-resident trail pass, and that's what this bill does, members. So I've got an amendment, an oral amendment that the DNR has brought to me that has to do with effective dates, and I've given that to council, Mr. Chairman, if council could repeat that and we could adopt that amendment.
Okay, Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, it'd be on page 2 of the bill. Page 2, line 10, delete April and insert January, and delete March and insert December. And then on page 3 after line 6, insert section 3 with the headnote effective date, which would read sections 1 and 2 are effective January 1st, 2010.
Okay. So, Representative Hackforth moves the oral amendment on page 2, line 2.10, strike April and insert January, and strike March and insert December. And on page 3, line 6, insert section 3, period, effective date, period, sections 1 and 2 are effective January 1st, 2010.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Thank you. I'd move that amendment.
Okay, Representative Hackforth moves the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have another amendment, and I apologize to the chairman and to the committee and to the committee administrator for not getting this to you sooner. This is my fault that I did not get this amendment to you. I had this in my office. I forgot about it. And reading over the bill while we were waiting here for some other bills to get done, I realized I had forgotten to bring this forward. So I do have this amendment that was passed out, and I do need to make some changes to the amendment too, Mr. Chairman, if you would be so kind to accept that at this time.
Sure. Go ahead with the oral amendment.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I would
first
move...
We'll move the amendment of the A09-0132 amendment, and go ahead, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 13, after the word possessing, scratch the or take out the word and insert a non-resident.
Okay, Representative Heck,
I'm not done though, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
And also, I forgot that it should have probably come before. After the word state on that same line, insert and grant-in-aid.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, that would read on that line, are operated on state and grant-in-aid trails by a non-resident possessing a non-resident all-terrain vehicle state trail pass.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Everybody understand the amendment?
Could I incorporate that in my amendment?
I believe, yeah, that would be okay. You can incorporate that. Yes. Representative Hackbarth incorporates the oral amendment, and Representative Hackbarth to the amendment.
The rest of the amendment, Mr. Chairman, this has to do with straightening out the issue of the, I talked about a little bit earlier about the requirements for the registration, and this takes care of that issue. So you're exempt in certain areas with the registration, so you don't have to do that if you have a trail pass.
Okay. Hey, thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Any questions? Okay. Representative Turner.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hackbarth, when they have these registrations, do they need to have some kind of photo ID when they look at the registration out of state, or is it just the name as when they do the registration?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm not quite following you. When we go to buy the trail pass, you mean?
Yeah, when they buy the trail pass.
When the non-resident goes to buy the trail pass, they just go to, like, wherever you go to buy a fishing license, like a Holiday gas station or something like that, and same requirements. Whatever you need to register
there.
Get
okay.
Trail pass. Yep.
Right.
Non-resident trail pass.
Okay.
That's all it is. Just like buying a non-resident fishing license.
Fishing license.
Yep.
Okay, great.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Hackbarth, any final comments?
That would be it on the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, all those in favor of the...
Right.
All those in favor of the A09-0132 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And to the bill as amended. Any questions? Representative Junkie.
Representative Hackbarth, I'm trying to figure this out. Are you registering the vehicle or the person?
Mr. Chairman, we took care of that with that last amendment. A non-resident riding a machine from out of state would have to have a trail pass. You don't have to have a trail pass if you're a non-resident riding a Minnesota registered machine.
You're registering the person, not the machine.
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, if you have a machine from out of state,
correct?
Wisconsin, for example.
Well, it's not registered Minnesota.
Not registered Minnesota. You have to have a non-resident trail pass.
For the machine or the person?
Well, for the person that's riding that machine.
And Mr. Chair, here's what I'm getting at, because I just handed in a bill today. The DNR does some funny things once in a while, and I found some funny stuff with our horse registration that I just handed a bill in for that'll be here, I hope, shortly. And there they register the person, not the horse. So now I got stable people riding me, literally and figuratively, saying, my God, I got three or four people riding the horse during the day and horse during the day, and each one of them now has to be registered, which is nuts. And so I'm asking, if Bill and I came from Wisconsin, brought one machine, he rode it in the morning, I rode it in the afternoon, do we both need to pay $20, or are you paying $20 for the machine? I can hand him the little pass when he rides it, and I can take the little pass when I ride it.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hagbarth.
The person has to have the permit.
So you want $40 from us to ride the
same machine.
That's correct. I'm not necessarily in support of a bill at this point.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Machine.
Well,
Representative Hagbarth.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Junkie, that's what we're doing now. We have to register these machines. Say it comes from Illinois, we have to register this machine in the state of Minnesota as a Minnesota machine, even though they might be here only a few days riding that machine on our trails, and they have to pay a $45 registration, and that's what we've got now.
But Mr. Chair, again, why don't we have the pass say this is for ATV, serial number, whatever,
well,
and then say, and there it is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and that's what I'm trying to get at. I'm trying to simplify the whole issue by being able, rather than going to a deputy registrar and doing what you want to do, Representative Junkie, I'm trying to make it easy so if somebody comes here on a Saturday and the deputy registrar's office is not open, they can go to a place where they can buy a fishing license
and
get a pass.
So, Mr. Chair, then I guess the question is, and maybe you know, or if you don't, the DNR come up and start explaining, but so their machine, their deputy register that where you buy your license, those little machines that we pay all this money for upkeep and all the fees and fines and charges and other things, isn't capable of doing a single license for a machine?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, that's correct. That's an issue that's taken care of through the deputy register's office. A little more complicated than that, doing it at the deputy register's office, than it is going to buy like a fishing license. I wanted to keep it simple so people could buy these permits or passes and make it easy on the weekends, for example.
Oh, Mr. Chair,
and that's the way, Representative Junkie, that's the way it is in Wisconsin,
sure.
You just buy a pass.
Again, I'm learning, I guess I don't care what Wisconsin does, but I'm trying to make it simpler too, and I think it's bizarre that you'd be registering every person. So now I got a family of four coming, two kids, two adults, we're all going to ride that machine over the weekend, and now you want me to buy four individual licenses at $80?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
Junkie, if they bring their machines here from another state, and I believe you're not going to have one machine for four people taking turns riding on it. Those people that are going to come here to ride are going to have four machines for those four people. They're not going to have one machine for four people.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, I'm not arguing with you. I'm arguing with the concept, and I don't know if you, DNR, brought this to you, if you dreamed it up. But
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie,
I'm trying to help you because I think what you're doing is right.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, I disagree. I've been to Wisconsin riding. I go to my sister's. And, we don't all hop on a machine at once. We'll sit at a camp and, play cards and drink pop, and then we'll take turns riding the machine. And that's the same way if I come up, I'm sure there's parks and state parks and other places where a machine will sit and family members individually will utilize it on the trail. I don't think you just, you're not getting on it and just going for hours and hours and hours like necessarily snowmobiles. ATVs a lot of times tend to be more recreational. I'm out for a half hour and back and I'm, but if you're utilizing the trail, again, I think, and again, what I'm looking for is I think eventually you're going to hear from folks that cater to these folks coming in, but now it's even more burdensome, whether it's a resort or a campground that's catering to these folks. They're going to start getting complaints now that, my whole family has to buy a $20 pass to utilize the machine we got in the back of the pickup out here on the State Aid Trail. And so, I'm trying to figure out a way you could register the machine. I think the machine should be registered, just like all our machines are licensed. I get that. But how do you register the machine? Just like we should register the horse and not 14 riders a day on the horse. Because that's what the wear and tear on the trail is not the person, but the machine. And so, I'm just trying to think of a way to do that. I don't know that this gets at it in a way that's correct.
Is there a possibility of amending it? I don't know if someone from the DNR could come down and address this issue. I don't know if it's a technical difficulty and if it's possible to just do the machine rather than the individual registration. Representative Dill, to this point.
Well, I don't... We snowmobiles are registered almost in every state, to my knowledge. They're already registered, and when a non-resident comes to Minnesota, they just buy a trail pass, and they get it off the ELS, and it costs $15 plus a $1 issuing fee, and it's good for the year. And I really don't care myself if the machine is registered or not. If it comes from Wisconsin, that it gets registered, even if the registration means they can ride on the trail. Why wouldn't we have something in the ELS that when a non-resident comes and wants to buy a non-resident trail pass, that they show their driver's license that they're a non-resident at the ELS, they pump out of the same little tiny sticker that we have put on a snowmobile, says T09 on it this year, and that has to be affixed to that ATV, whether it's from Arizona or Iowa or North Dakota or whatever, and that goes on there, and there's no registration on it at all, because their state doesn't require registration. That's just my question. Let's just sell them a trail pass, not a registration.
Well,
could we
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bill, that's exactly what this is. It's a trail pass, but it's not going to be affixed to the machine.
But
it's just like the horse trail pass. You carry that in your wallet like you would this, too. It's not something you would attach to the machine.
And
Representative Bill.
Well, that's, I guess, the whole crux of the argument, then. We agree on the how to do it, but it's on the matter of whether it's for the person or for the machine.
Mm-hmm. And we said that since we are doing snowmobiles that way, why wouldn't it be possible to do that with ATVs? I don't know, Representative Hackbarth.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to have. I've never cared for putting stickers on machines, and you know, you get that big ugly sticker that you get from Wisconsin, and people have to stick that on their machines, and I didn't like that idea, so that's why I tried to avoid the sticker issue, so you didn't have to stick those stickers all over your machine, and a lot of people have some nice paint jobs, even on their sled, and they don't want those stud sticker passes and those kinds of things pasted all over their machine, so I was trying to avoid that.
Okay.
And
Representative Dill, follow up.
Well, to that point, where I live is kind of a snowmobile haven, and frankly, I think it's a badge of honor when somebody pulls into the Boyd Deer Lodge and they have Montana and Wyoming and Utah and Idaho and Wisconsin and Michigan, all those stickers all over their sled. I mean, that means that they have been all over the place. And I mean, I don't hear anybody complain. You know, Representative Hackbarth, I agree with what you're trying to do. I just don't agree with how the exact way you're implementing it. I didn't understand the bill to be for the person. Yeah, I thought it was for the machine.
Well,
and in fact, that little sticker is so small that I just don't see it as an issue. And frankly, they just have to do what we tell them, or they don't come here.
Well, Representative Dill and Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, I did want to do it for the person. I disagree with the fact that people come here to ride their ATVs, and they bring one ATV and four people to ride. That just doesn't happen. I ride ATVs all the time, and I'm on the trails all the time, and you just don't see that happening. People come here to ride ATVs and to ride the trail, and they're out there having fun as a family, but they don't come and bring one ATV and four people to ride one machine. That just doesn't happen.
Okay.
I understand the concept of residents having an issue like that, where they live here and might have one machine, and they take it camping or they ride the machine from their home or whatever, and they go out on trails and they take turns riding it. But that doesn't happen when people come here to ride ATVs and ride the trails.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I remember what my question was. Representative Hackbarth, earlier in your testimony way back, you said something about a $50 fee. And apologizing because there was a lot of dialogue going on here, so I hope you remember. Okay, and in here it says 20.
Right.
I'm just wondering if you can clarify what the difference when you said 40, 50 some, or 50 and then 20. No?
Of course. The issue was with $45, not 50.
Oh, 45.
And that's what it costs to register an ATV in the state of Minnesota. And if somebody came here and their machine wasn't registered, they'd have to register it as a Minnesota machine for $45.
Before
they could ride on any of our trails.
Okay, and...
And Representative Bigham.
So you're going to charge non-residents $20 for this particular thing?
Annual pass.
Annual pass.
No, okay.
Just wanted to make sure I had my fees numbers right.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and with all respect to Representative Junkie, I understand Representative Hackart's what you're trying to do, and I do agree with you, and we'll be voting with you. So, thank you.
Huh? And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Some of these new ATVs are 2-up, and if there's 2 people riding, would each person on that one machine have to have a sticker?
Representative Hackart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, just the operator.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
What? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hackart, is it possible that you could carry the sticker on your person and that would apply for you driving the ATV, but if Representative Junkie came with his 4 children and all 5 of them, if he put the sticker on the machine, I'm trying to understand, would you be happy and would Representative Junkie be happy potentially? Is there anything in the bill that doesn't allow the sticker to be put on the machine? Well, Representative Junkie got the sticker from the ELS, and he decided to put the sticker on the machine. What would be the effect of...
Mr. Chairman, according to this bill, it's not a sticker. It's just a pass that you buy, like a fishing license, and you carry it in your wallet. It's not a sticker.
But...
And Representative...
The way the bill's written now.
Right, but Representative Hackbart, if I'm not mistaken, all of the papers that come out of the ELS, don't they have sticky backs still?
No.
Well, they changed them, didn't they? Oh, yeah, sorry.
And the permit or that you purchased, that would have the name affixed to the person, that so it's non-transferable?
Right.
And Representative Zaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hackbart, so... back to kind of Representative McNamara's scenario, if Representative Junkie was coming from Wisconsin with his 4 children, could I don't know how many he's got.
I don't think he does either.
Sorry. You know, Mr. Chair, to that point, you know, actually, I'm really for the bill. But the amount of per diem that Representative Junkie collects, he can afford 4 passes.
Okay, Representative Zaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for the diversion. Would this bill preclude, take away the current registration system so that he could instead register his ATV with a $45 fee if that worked out better for him?
Representative Hackart.
Mr. Chairman, if he wanted to register his machine as a Minnesota machine, he could still do that, yes.
Okay. Representative Zaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the two would at least somewhat be compatible. You know, you could have the trail pass with the person, and if the out-of-state person wanted to instead register their machine, they could do that.
Well, any comments? I think next time, Representative Organia.
Thank you. I'm thinking about the money here. I don't care where it's carried, but how much money the state gets. So if you're in Minnesota, you register your machine for $45, and you live right over the border in Wisconsin, you can get a trail pass for $20 and spend as much time on the trails in Minnesota because you live right on the other side of the border. Doesn't that mean that Minnesota residents are subsidizing somebody who's just coming across the border?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hackbart.
Representative Unius is a $20 annual pass. If they were... the $45 covers a 3-year registration. If they wanted to come here annually for 3 years in a row, it would be $60.
We can't get more money from Wisconsin residents.
It would be $20 annual.
I get that. I'm just thinking of our budget. Well, we can discuss this later.
Okay. And to go back to what Representative Zaskowski, you were talking about, as far as the fee that would be required on registered vehicles from Wisconsin now as well. So it doesn't matter if they're registered in another state under this bill, they would still have to pay the fee. So, and let's see, Representative Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was going to clarify the difference between registering the machine and the person, because the person that is going to the holiday store or what have you, you know, have to go to the deputy register. I think that was part of the interested things than the Representative Hackbar was trying to make too, you know, not only the prices, but the convenience of it for the weekend, that kind of thing.
And,
thank you.
And Representative Bigham.
Okay.
Trail pass? Any any other questions? Okay, seeing none, Representative Hackbar.
Mr. Chairman, I'd renew my motion, and the bill will be going to Representative Wagenius' committee. If we have any other issues, we can maybe straighten them out there.
We did? I think we did. Yeah. Representative Hackbarth renews his motion that House File 487, as amended, be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Okay, Representative Hackbarth, your next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move House File 924 be recommended to pass, and I'm not sure. I think the bill could probably go to the General Register.
General Register.
Okay.
Sure. And so Representative Hackbarth moves House File 924 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
And, Mr. Chairman, to make things a little simpler and to clean it all at once, I would move the delete all amendment to get it in the shape I'd like.
Okay. Representative Hackbarth moves the delete all amendment, the A09-0161 amendment. That's the correct amendment?
Correct.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. And amendment is adopted. Representative Hackbarth to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill to, my original bill was to change the North Shore Trail to the C.J. Ramstead Memorial Trail. And probably Representative Bill could probably talk a little bit more about C.J. Ramstead than I can, but I knew C.J. Ramstead very, very well. And he was an outdoor snowmobile and off-road photographer and a columnist and magazine publisher and editor, and was killed in a car accident a couple of years ago, and I think this is an appropriate thing to do to rename that North Shore Trail to C.J. Ramstead Memorial Trail. And Representative Bill, the trail I believe is in your district, and and the rest of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is an issue that the DNR was bringing forward. We're going to have it as a separate bill. We just thought we'd have included in this one as long as we're changing another trail, another ATV trail, so or the Ramstead Trail, the snowmobile trail. But this other issue is a snow ATV trail in the Nemadji State Forest. And Commissioner Meyer would like to explain that.
Hey, welcome, Mr. Meyer.
Members, thank you very much. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And I've handed out a map, just I think it's the easiest way to describe what's going on here. What we're doing in the amendment is, you can see if you go to the back side in Section 2, on lines 2.8 to 2.9, we're deleting a segment that's known as the Boundary Trail, and it originates in Tsavo County and extends into Duluth and St. Louis County. And as Representative Hackbarth said, this forest, or this trail, does, if you look at the back of the map, it's a more detailed map that shows the Willard Munger State Trail. And it's in this segment here, you can see the boundary segment on the right side that actually goes through St. Croix State Park, St. Croix State Forest, and the Nemadji State Forest, which is a snowmobile ATV motorized trail. You'll see on the left side here, and if you start up by Carlton, you can see the segment is actually the Hinckley Duluth fire segment of the Willard Munger Trail, which is the motorized trail system. Several years ago, we recodified the Willard Munger Trail system and included both of these segments, perhaps erroneously, but it didn't come to our attention that there was a Willard Munger motorized and a Willard Munger non-motorized segment of the trail. What we're trying to do here is take the motorized segment, which you see, as I mentioned, goes through the park, and then two sections of state forest, and put that in the Arrowhead Trail section, to avoid confusion. It's confusing to users, and we've had a couple instances where someone has shown up to the non-motorized part of the trail with their snowmobiles and ready to go, and all of a sudden they realize this is the non-motorized part of the Willardmonger Trail, and then vice versa a little bit. So we're trying to clarify. The non-motorized is the tar segment that goes through the segment we're looking to move into the Arrowhead section of the statute is the motorized piece. And if you go to the full map system, Mr. Chair and members, you'll see this segment again where I talked about coming from Carlton going through down to Hinckley is what's existing right now is the motorized or the non-motorized hard surface or paved trail system. And then that dashed line from Hinckley down onto the Willardmonger Gateway segment is the segment that we've established in statute that we're in the process of acquiring and developing right now. And it also shows that fragmented segment of motorized trail over there. So, Mr. Chair, members, since this section of law was being opened up, we wanted to be able to take advantage of clarification of this segment, and that's clearly all we're trying to do. We're not trying to change any purposes or uses or intent. Just clarify what is motorized and what's non-motorized.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Meyer. Any questions at all? Representative Sterner, I believe, is first.
I was just wondering, I know we're not a fiscal one, but what kind of like signage and cost of that would occur with this change, if any?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hackbar.
If you look at the fines in Section 3 on page 2, it says that the funds from non-state sources sufficient to erect the fine. So it doesn't cost anything.
All right. State. Thank you, Representative.
Okay, and Representative Wagenius.
Yes, this is only coming to this committee, so help me out here. Have you talked to the legislators along this segment of the Willardmonger boundary segment? Have you talked to those legislators?
Madam Chair, members, I'm in the process of doing that right now, and I will communicate with all of them before it reaches to the floor. If there is a problem, we can most certainly withdraw that language at that point in time. This is meant as a non-controversial clarification, and I would assume that all members would be comfortable with that. That's my intent.
Representative Wagenius.
When you say you're in the process, how many members have you talked to already, and that they said, yeah, I don't need to know who, but it just I need to have an understanding of that.
Commissioner Meyer.
Madam Chair, I haven't been able to get in touch with the people who this is going to be affecting. We've been trading like ships and that kind of. I've been stuck in other committees, and they've been stuck in other committees. I can certainly let you folks know when that is done forthwith within the next couple of days.
Any other questions? Okay, I see none. So, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I renew my motion to House File 924 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register as amended.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth renews his motion that House File 924 as amended be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and the bill is passed.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Thank you, Commissioner Meyer.
Thank you.
Next, Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 376.
Representative Dill moves House File 376 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance.
Okay, and I have an oral amendment to start with, and that would be delete Section 2 starting on 1.20 through 1.23.
Okay. And Representative Dill, I guess the printed amendment that you have,
The
A1 amendment does do that.
All right. So I'll withdraw that, and then I'd like to then adopt the H0376A1 amendment to the bill to get it in the... Actually, I want to do two amendments to get it in the shape that I want, and then I'll explain the bill as amended. So it'd be the 0376A1 and the 090134 amendment.
Okay, and first we'll do the A1 amendment. Representative Dill moves the A1 amendment to get it in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And next, Representative Dill moves the A09-0134 amendment, once again, to get the bill in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted, and Representative Dill to the bill is amended.
Okay, Section 1, Mr. Chair. You will notice that it is adding lakes in Cook County to the marked snowmobile trail system on ice. Now, these trails already exist. If you think back a couple, I think dating back to probably 2003 or 4, and before that. But since I've been in the legislature, we've been adding lakes as we've discovered that they've been in the system, but not officially. And, for example, the Lake of the Woods was added a couple of years ago, and a couple of lakes south of Orr were added because they were already being groomed, already being marked, but because they're on ice, they need to be designated specifically. And so when the DNR recently GPSed the entire trail system statewide, it was discovered that these lakes were not in the trail system, even though the snowmobile club that maintains those trails was claiming that it was in the snowmobile trail system. So this is, in my view, a technical change. I think it represents about 5 miles of total trail on the ice, of which people have been using, and it's been marked and groomed. And so this gets it into the chain of lakes that extends from Lake of the Woods all the way over to Grand Portage. And as I understand it, will also then provide the liability limitations that are in, I can't remember what those are called, tort liability, or maybe Representative Lugenius can help us, but there's some liability issues there as well. That's the first section. And then the A1 amendment basically incorporated what the Hackbarth bill did that we just heard before, where it renamed the North Shore Trail to C.J. Ramstead, and then did what the DNR had asked regarding the Willard Munger Trail, that section of the Willard Munger Trail. Then the last amendment that we adopted, the 0134 amendment, that has to do with operating off-highway motorcycles, and I'd like for Mr. Bone to come down and explain the what this exactly does. It refers to the accompany definition in 84787, which is specific to motorcycles.
Okay.
Mr. Bone is not here, coming down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Humphries, and I represent the Off-Highway Motorcycle Organization within the state, the Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association, also a division of the American Motorcyclist Association, and we had come forth asking for this amendment. What we're looking for here is to say that the operator of the motorcycle can be accompanied by any adult regardless of what vehicle they're on. We run into things now where up at like the Gilbert, the Iron Range Vehicle Park, where if mom wanted to sit in a lawn chair and watch the kid, supervise the kid in the tot area, it says that she can't do that right now. She has to be sitting on a motorcycle to do so. And the other piece that we want to be able to deal with is mixed-use families. If we have a trail system that allows the use of ATVs and motorcycles, and the kid happens to be riding on a motorcycle, the parents can't ride the ATV. It says by law here they have to ride a motorcycle to be accompanying that child. So that's the main piece we're looking for in here. And then the line 115 and 116 gets into organized events, where we have special use permitted events on state land in some cases, or county or private land, and we want to be able to have the kids be able to participate in that event, excuse me, in that supervised event without having to have the parent, like, right there with them, or the adult. They go in groups, and you can have they're followed through with sweep riders, and there's adults all throughout the course, watching the course and making sure the kids come through. But in this case, we wanted to be able, through permit, if the commissioner chooses to allow so, to be able to have that type of event.
Thank you. And could you spell your name for us, please?
The last name is UMPHRESS.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Umpress.
I can answer any questions.
Sure. Any questions at all for Mr. Umpress? Okay. Seeing none.
Any questions on the bill as amended, I'd be happy to address if members want to address it.
We have one more person that would like to testify. No? Okay. Any questions for Representative Taylor?
Mr. Chair, actually my question is for Representative Dill, not for the testifier. So sure. I didn't realize. I thought they were through.
Okay. If there's no questions, are there any questions for Mr. Umpress? Seeing none, thank you very much. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dill, my question actually, questions are similar in there for both of the amendments. With regard to the A1 amendment, I'm just wondering what will happen if new trails happen to be found on other lakes. Will they then be given the same treatment and just kind of incorporated into the whole system? Does it, how does that happen, that trails that were unknown now become known and become part of the whole system?
I can answer that question.
Okay.
Representative Dill.
Well, first off, they were not unknown. They were known. They've been marked and groomed for years. These on these particular lakes. They were known. They even on the map. But what hadn't happened to them is they hadn't been named specifically in law, because the trails that are on ice are named in law from Lake of the Woods County now all the way to Grand. When this passes, all the way to Grand Portage. Before I proposed the bill, we went to the Minnesota United Snowmobile Association and asked for their endorsement of doing this exact thing. And when we worked with them, they were far more concerned about Section 2 that was deleted, where it said that the commissioner would add community access trails, because that's far more ambiguous in the sense that which trails are those going to be, how many miles of trail are those going to be, et cetera, et cetera. And so that is the reason, because we couldn't come to an agreement on that. That's the reason that that section was deleted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dill, thank you for the explanation. I just am concerned about precedents being set, and I wanted to make sure why, that this trail is going to be incorporated, and obviously, as you explained, it has been in use and groomed for a number of years. But I guess I just am always concerned about precedents being set and proliferation of trails of various types, and what happens, is there creep going on over the years? So I just was curious as to what your thought was with that, and I think you may have answered that.
Representative Dill.
Well, when this first started, I think back in I'm not sure when it was. It was probably somewhere between 96 and 98. And don't hold me right to the year. The first set of lakes that were included in law, because there were no ice trails that were permitted under the system, were in Voyageurs National Park. And I know that Senator Johnson and Representative Bach were then the legislators that represent that area. And since then, we have promulgated laws that have established this trail along the border, essentially, from Lake of the Woods now to Grand Portage. And one of the reasons that happened is because the ice conditions are so predictable in that part of the country that it was feasible to do so. And so whether or not someone might come in and propose that they have a trail that would cross Mille Lacs, they certainly might. But I'm
relatively certain that that trail wouldn't be designated unless we had agreement between the DNR. We thought we had enough resources in the Snowmobile Trail account, and the NUSA endorsed it as well.
Thank you. Any, other questions? Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dill, or Representative Dill, I'm kind of wondering about the liability we might gain by just having the blanket additional lakes at the discretion of the commissioner. With the president, we've had over lakes before, but is there additional liabilities that would, since it's an unknown factor?
Could we have Dill? Mr. Potter's in the audience. Could he come down and talk about the recreational trail liability issue that's in law presently?
Welcome, Mr. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Potter with Parks and Trails, Department of Natural Resources. The current liability law, tort liability law that's in place is, I think that Representative Hill is referring to, is 3.736, which states that if recreational opportunities are provided and the users are not charged an annual or a fee every time they enter that trail, they are covered under the State of Minnesota liability law, which basically says they owe them no more responsibility than a trespasser. So it gives them very good liability coverage.
Thank you.
And Representative Wagenius.
When you look at the added language on 1.13 and 1.14, do you see any additional costs to the state?
And Mr. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wagenius, no, not at this time. Those, like Representative Hill has stated, those trails have been in the system. But when we did the GPSing, we did not include them because we were taking the position that if it's an ice trail, it has to be legislatively authorized. So the funding has already been there to fund those ice trails.
That's Senator Wagenius.
So that takes care of line 1.13 and additional lakes at the discretion of the commissioner. Do you see any other additional financing that needs to be provided?
Mr. Chairman,
Potter.
Representative Genius, our preference would be not to have that in there. We would rather that each lake was identified in statute, but
Representative Dale.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to delete after the word Hungry Jack, put a period and delete the rest of the language all the way through the end of line 1.14 if I don't have to go to Representative Wagenius's committee. Well, I mean, it's not a financial issue after that because Mr. Potter already said that the money's been appropriated and spent on the trail, and all we're doing is putting it in law so that they're specific and that it's properly documented and covered. So there's really no fiscal impact to this entire bill if I delete that. So, Representative Wagenius, are you okay with that?
I believe...
Well, I certainly would like to delete that then. After the word Hungry Jack, insert a period, strike all the rest of the language through the end of line 1.14.
And Ms. Taylor will read the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would read on line 1.13... After the first semicolon, insert an and delete the second semicolon, and then on line 1.14, delete additional lakes at the discretion of the commissioner.
Okay. Everybody understand the amendment?
Mr. Chair, there is just harmony between Representative Wagenius and I. Isn't that nice? Thank
you. What do you think? Isn't that nice?
Well, you can say that. I just think it's nice.
Okay, everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Any other questions? I believe, did you have a question, Representative Saylor? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bill. And this is just purely a question about safety because I just simply didn't understand this part. And that's with regard to the A1 amendment.
Okay.
I think that one, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, the wrong one. It was the other one, the 134, with the off-highway motorcycle. I was just wondering, you know, this language about, you know, having, you know, the intent seemed to have been before to make sure that there was, you know, parental accompaniment. And I just want to know, you know, is it, are we still taking care of the safety issues? I understand that not always do parents want to go along on things, but, you know, why was that language in there in the first place? And is it just something that over time, as we see how things have worked out, it turned out not to be necessary? That's just my concern.
And good question, Representative Saylor. If you look under 84.787, subdivision 2, you'll see that accompanied means under the direct control. So that means that it's not like you can, you know, be in another, on another piece of property. You know, you have to be under direct control, meaning that doesn't mean on another vehicle necessarily. But, I mean, as the example was given, there's places where you can go on an ATV, a youth, on an ATV or a motorcycle, and there's tracks, for example. And the parent, you know, under the present law, would have to be on another motorcycle. But they could be in a parking lot across the street sitting on the motorcycle. They'd still be legal. So what we're doing is we're making it so they can be sitting in a lawn chair or sitting in their vehicle next to the track and be able to be under direct control of that person.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm always curious about the direct control with persons under 18, but anyway, good luck. That was just my concern, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
And hey, Mr. Chair, now that so the motion would be to send this to the
General Register. That is correct, and I don't know, do we need to amend the motion? Okay, just incorporate that in. So Representative Dill incorporates, change the motion, send it to the General Register. And Representative Dill, you want to renew the motion?
I certainly would, thank you.
Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 376, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. And with that, meeting is adjourned.